Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest-running podcast, now in our 16th year. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of the podcast, and this week we sit down with Nick Hogan, the CEO of Real Metrics, on how his company assists casinos and manufacturers in figuring out what slot games are preferred by customers and why. 20 years ago, IGT transformed the industry by introducing cashless gaming with Tito. Now IGT is revolutionizing cashless yet again. Learn more about IGT's resort wallet at igt.com/cashless. Seems like all we really want to do. The emergence of analytics and big data have opened up the study of how slot games are perceived and consumed by players. When Nick Hogan founded Real Metrics along with John Bushi and William Schoofs, they pledged to use big data and analytics to help both operators and manufacturers streamline their knowledge of the game business. Real Metrics' mission is to map the slot genome and in the process supercharge the returns of its subscribers, employees, shareholders, and the industry at large. He spoke with GGB editor Frank Legato from his office in March.
Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast. Joining us today is Nick Hogan, who is co-founder and CEO of Real Metrics, a company that helps operators and manufacturers utilize the benefits of big data to better understand what makes slots and slot floors successful. Thanks for being with us today, Nick.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Frank.
Tell us a bit about what led you to found Real Metrics in 2014 and what the company's main mission is.
Sure. Well, I wish I could give you an epiphany story, but it was honestly more of a slow burn. So I've spent all of my 26 years in the industry on the supply side, and I've always had a global mandate with really great access to a pretty incredible array of operators and operational environments. And as I roamed the earth working these environments, scores of small observations really began coalescing into like larger central tendencies. And if there was one, you know, truly common thread that I began to notice, it was what I describe as kind of a tortured relationship with objective fact and empirical truth all throughout the industry. And we as an industry, we accumulate enormous volumes of insanely rich data, which over the years we've largely ignored. And there's really has been an insufficient focus on things like data fidelity and hygiene. A lot of the analytical work is fairly topical and perfunctory. There is never any data pooling for incremental statistical power, and really no application of scientific method that really helps to firm up insights and things of this nature. So whether it was operations or supply, the prevailing evaluative model in everything that everybody was doing was, of course, trial and error, and not surprisingly, inefficiencies and imbalances were pretty much everywhere. And then beyond that, there were also what I would describe as kind of the hallmarks of thought and practice that tend to precede the democratization of large knowledge bases, right? So anecdote was really ruling the day, and we have rules of thumb, old adages, maxims, hearsay, quite a bit of defensiveness about all of it. So it's all these, you know, effects and coping mechanisms that we see when humans are interpreting realities devoid of voluminous, you know, reliable evidence. So myself coming from an econometrics background, I was very confident that answers to a lot of these problems were in the data, and that democratizing the data would create enormous operational and developmental efficiencies. So as my partners, William Schoofs and John Bauschi and I really dug in and began contemplating where we could go with this, we realized that it would ultimately afford us with some incredible opportunities, especially the ability to gain an unprecedented degree of insight into nothing short of the human proclivity to gamble. And so ultimately, this really became our mission, mapping the slot genome, as we call it. So it's taking everything that we're learning in product everything that we're learning about players and exploring that intersection to secure fundamental insights into desired behaviors and then the product designs and product features that that catalyze and reinforce them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Explain the different types of analytics your company performs for clients, how each is designed to optimize casino performance.
Okay. Well, first, before we even touch on analytics, there's the cleanup, right? Which is a very big deal. So this is always step one. If you've kicked around slot systems for any amount of time, you know that data quality is a colossal problem. And if you don't get this sorted up front, everything else is for naught. So that's really the first place we focus. It's hugely beneficial to our subscribers. Additionally, our data collection process is entirely automated. So we also spend a bit of prep time working with IT organizations to get the relevant routines installed, scheduled, and secured. Now, once all that stuff is sorted, then you have access to the platform and you dive in and there you have three application groups on offer. So there's on-demand analytics, predictive analytics, and prescriptive analytics. So in on-demand analytics, the users control the queries. So this includes accessing, you know, shrink-wrapped reports, filterable tables and visualizations. We even have a, you know, blank canvas BI utility that lets you create custom analytical models or export data sets for offline analysis. So that's on demand and it's a traditional means through which you can go in and really mine these massive data sets that we host. Next up, we have predictive analytics, which is all, you know, driven by inferential statistics. And there it's really focused on assessing the star potential, as we call it, of each new title that comes to market. So what we'll do there is we'll take, we have a body of products which ultimately prove to be incredibly successful. And when new products come out, we compare those design stacks, and then we look at consumption tendencies at equivalent life cycle stages. And then this gives us the ability to make some predictions as to whether the game has legs and whether it's going to be successful ultimately. Now, with predictive, obviously, you always have to take it with a bit of a grain of salt because there is there are larger margins of error in that. But by and large, it's pretty good and good directional guidance for brand new stuff. And then third, we have our most popular application group, which is called prescriptive analytics. And here, what we use is an AI-fueled recommendation engine that it basically just scans your inventory 24/7, compares it to the Pan Industrial data set, sees how you're doing relative to Industrial Optima in terms of configuration settings and whatnot, and then begins to serve you immediately actionable insights. So there are three groups, sub-apps in there. The first one is one we call STARS, and what that does is it alerts you to sure thing products that are really performing exceptionally well in all environments, but you don't have them. So it's really a great way to put together your purchasing lists. Then from there, we have what we call DOGS, which alerts you to the truly abysmal or unfixable product that you do have. So everybody knows what on their floor doesn't work, but they don't always have the answer to the question, can it be fixed? And if it lands in our DOGS bucket, the answer is a hard no. And then third, and it's by far our most popular application, it's highlighting products that should be performing well, but aren't. And this is really, it's what we call anomalies. And so we're seeing anomalous performance, downside anomalous performance, and it really gives you the ability to get in there with very targeted configuration adjustments in order to turn around performance. And it's popular because, fundamentally, these are game-changing tweaks that cost you absolutely nothing. And then on top of this, in December of last year, we created a professional services group internally called RealMetrics CSM, that really focuses on turnkey analytics. So it's things like, performance management and things of this nature that we're doing actually for the operators. And we did this really for two reasons. First, the pandemic has really hit the P&A departments and the operators pretty hard. So there are fewer analysts in circulation and quite a bit more demand for outsourced analytics. And then secondly, we did it to correct what I view as a strategic blunder on my part. And that is when you move from a four-wall analytical paradigm to four-wall plus pan-industrial, that is by definition a paradigm shift. And initially, I'd really assumed that we could kind of just push the operators into that deep end and they'd get up to speed solo. And in retrospect, that was definitely off the mark. So we've been doing it not only to perform the turnkey analytics, but also do a better a job of easing people into that paradigm shift.
For big money thrills, IGT's Wheel of Fortune slots is the one your players seek. The game that's awarded over $3.3 billion in jackpots is celebrating 25 years as a top-performing slot brand. With more than 1,100 millionaires created in a quarter of a century, Wheel of Fortune slots delivers heart-pounding thrills for every player every time. Celebrate with us as we unveil the new Wheel of Fortune games and player promotions designed to drive excitement to your floor. Visit IGT.com/WOFslots25 for more information. Now back to our podcast.
Just a couple of follow-up questions here. Does the casino management system in place when you arrive at an operator client, does that still collect the data, or is this data you're collecting in addition to that, or is it along with that, or are you reinterpreting the data that's already collected?
So the data are always going to be collected by the slot management system. And so what we're doing is we're actually taking an extract from that slot management system. So what we do is in some cases, we've worked with suppliers to establish interfaces that do that automatically, that they're just plugins that they kick out. In other cases, we give them what we call extraction scripts, which enable them to basically implement, and then those scripts, what they do is they anonymize data, they compile it, they encrypt it, and then they automatically transfer it to landing zones that we make available in our platform as a destination for the data. So yeah, all those systems are absolutely still in place. We're just extracting from them.
Okay, and the other question I have is it's obvious the benefits operators will receive from your services, but suppliers are also your clients, and I just wanted you to mention what it is you do for the suppliers as well as the operators.
Well, it's the suppliers just like a standalone operator that doesn't have much in the way of inventory. The suppliers are also starved for data. They always have been. And when we get into we find ourselves often in the position where we kind of mediate between operators and suppliers, and there's this kind of back and forth with, well, you guys don't give us data, and so it's very difficult for us to manufacture really resonant products. And at the same time, the operator is saying, well, if we give you data, then the problem is always that you start fleecing us on the business model. So we end up brokering information in a central position there. But they're looking at kind of the same stuff. They want to understand how it is that products compare with one another, and what those meter sets look like, and just getting a far better view on the performance of not only their own products but also their competitors' products.
Okay. Now, that is how my next question actually kind of answers it: is how can big data help casinos and manufacturers improve their products? Analytics are obviously allowing them to dig deep beyond the standard win per machine numbers that have been used for years and years.
Yeah, I would say, you know, first and foremost, it's the incremental statistical power that comes from much larger and much cleaner data sets. So the fact of the matter is that simply by virtue of our neutral position, our tech, and our reputation for discretion and integrity, we can aggregate more and typically more insightful data than any traditional operator or supplier. Secondly, another thing is that our perspectives are simply different, right? We don't look at data in the same way. Our scope, our context, our metrics, there's really a lot of unique methodology there. Its efficacy is absolutely proven, and our subscribers really value it enormously. So generally, it's that we can serve insights that truly transcend the capabilities of traditional operational or supply side organizations. And then you're right to ask about the data compiled, because it's an absolutely critical point. So in addition to going broad, you know, really getting the pan-industrial numbers and pulling them in from a bunch of different markets, we go very deep. So we accumulate comprehensive meter sets, comprehensive configs, comprehensive design and classification attributes that are supplied by the suppliers, and then a lot of information about the environments in which the machines operate. And additionally, if you opt in on providing anonymized session data, which is completely optional, it's an entirely different kettle of fish. It's actionability on steroids. And so when you look at this and you look at, you know, some of the other stuff that's out there, I mean, leaderboards, top tens of of index theos and things of this nature, they're casually interesting during purchasing season. We publish such indices. But that's really where the applicability ends, at least in terms of anything actionable. So we're far more focused on a holistic view and answering far more material questions. So do we know the segments we serve? Do we have the right product for these segments? Do we have enough of it? Is it configured correctly? Are we promoting it correctly? And so forth. So for these sorts of questions, you know, you need to go beyond manually compiled index values. They don't answer those questions. And I would say, in many cases, they may do as much harm as they do good.
So you can compare games to the universe of, say, strip casinos, integrated resorts, as opposed to regional casinos, locals casinos. The different markets, I imagine, would generate different data sets. Is that correct?
Yeah, you can. We certainly give everybody the ability to drill down into all sorts of different levels of detail, no doubt about it. And with respect to, you know, regional differences, one of the more interesting things that we found early on, you know, we always test a lot of our own assumptions, or we test perspectives that are out there in the market. And one of the things that we found was that the consistency in performance from market to market. So the old adage was always, you know, what a game's performance in one market has no relevance to its performance in another market. Well, we established very early on that although it wasn't 100% bunk, it was really a good solid 95. So what we see is that the consistency in performance from market to market is far more consistent than anybody had thought historically. And what we do with this, Frank, is, you know, it's still one of those beliefs that's clung to by a lot of folks. So we just skip that debate entirely, and we just express on every single game, whenever we put a performance number up there, we show the degree of intermarket dispersion. So we quantify it with every single metric that we put out.
Okay. Now, you use several key terms as they relate to game performance in your reports and your apps. Let's start with the basics, like sticky versus slippery slots and the ricochet tendency. Can you explain those terms to me?
You bet. Yeah, these terms, and it's emblematic of the way that we approach it. I said we have pretty unique perspectives. So if we find analytical paradigms lacking, we create a new one. If we don't like metrics, or we think they're simply insufficiently informative, we define new ones. And so with sticky, slippery, and ricochet, these terms all relate to our company's obsession with asset productivity, player productivity, and the interplay between the two. So we can start with sticky slots. So sticky slots are inherently productive assets with the proven ability to capture and captivate players. Slippery slots are inherently unproductive assets that discourage and deflect players. And then ricochet is a footfall effect where players spend an inordinate amount of time pinballing from slippery slot to slippery slot until something sticky snags them. Now, there are two issues here. So first, we've yet to see a single slot floor anywhere in the industry that we would not describe as grossly over-diversified. There's simply too much variety out on the floors. And then to make matters worse, the floors are ridiculously slippery, with unproductive assets outnumbering productive by either 4-to-1 or 5-to-1. Those are the two ratios that we see just over and over again. So what's happening is that players are spending far too much time transitioning from lousy experience to lousy experience. And needless to say, the value destruction in this is absolutely dramatic. So whether you're talking about a time-constrained player or a budget-constrained player, 50% hits to player productivity are by no means unusual. And importantly, this is where the problems start. It hits player productivity, asset productivity, and by extension, floor productivity. But what's really important here to consider is that it's of what it's doing to player perceptions. So you get confusion, boredom, the feeling of being fleeced, all of it undermining loyalty. It's really toxic stuff, and from what we've seen, just damn near ubiquitous industrially.
Do you drill down into elements of the slots that are sticky and slippery? In other words, do you find that the same types of features lead to sticky slots, and the same types of features are making slots slippery? Is there a consistency there?
Yeah, we see tendencies. I mean, we're somewhat early days on what we call the attribute analysis, and really looking heavily into the really detailed components of the design stack. But yes, we do some of this already. We're doing more and more of it on the hardware side. That's an interesting one, because what we see is that a lot of the expense that's been layered into the hardware platforms over the last decade or so, a lot of it really doesn't appear to be justified. So we're building out those capabilities more and more each day, and it's exciting stuff. And we are seeing, indeed, you're starting to see pretty serious tendencies in some of these design stacks.
Mm-hmm. And was that pretty much universal data from all the markets that you used to ascertain that slot players are just bombarded with too much variety on a slot floor?
Yeah, we really see it. I'm sorry, Frank. I kind of lost it. Can you ask that again?
Yes. I was just wondering how universal in the casinos you were looking at that the conclusion that there's too much variety applies. Does it apply to everywhere?
Yeah. I mean, not a single floor comes to mind that I would describe as being, you know, optimally diverse. It's all heavily over diversified. No doubt about it.
That's quite interesting. And are you looking at all types of games, video poker as well as slot games? This is the whole floor of all styles of games, ETGs, everything.
Our bias has really been in slot product to date, and that's just a function of the priority given it by the operators and the suppliers. Everybody's really strongly focused on slots. There are also, in the video poker realm, there are some reconciliation complications that make You know, heavy analysis on poker, a little bit difficult, but in each of these areas where we continue to plow forward and we're getting more and more capabilities in these different game types, month after month.
How has reduced capacity due to COVID-19, how has that affected what you do and the data that you're getting? Is the fact that there's less variety because there's a restricted floor and every other game cut off, has that helped at all? Or are you helping operators pick the sticky slots and make sure that they remain active?
With our professional services unit, we've started doing more and more of this, turnkey analytical work where they're asking us to do performance management. So this means managing configurations, selecting product for purchase, selecting product for removal. So we do a fair bit of that these days. It's something we started last year, and it's really been going like gangbusters.
Is there anything else that you've identified that slot directors are doing wrong or interpreting, or things that they have that have been longstanding practices that you've noted are not making them money?
Yeah, and I think I'm glad you asked the question, and I'm particularly happy that you phrased it that way, because it gives me a chance to dispel a kind of a common misconception about how we view the miscellaneous inefficiencies that we're attacking. So from the top, the slot directors are doing nothing wrong, right? So they've simply been given the wrong tools. So if you ask somebody to clear a forest with a hatchet, you can't be surprised if half of it has grown back by the time you're done, right? So it's just the way that it goes. But when we first start with new subscribers, we often encounter a bit of anxiety and trepidation in the slot teams, right? But that tends to melt away pretty quickly. First, we're just nerds, right? So like the least threatening people around. secondly, we clarify up front that with precious little variability, everyone starts in the same place. So whether you're the most sophisticated multi-jurisdictional operator on earth or a sawdust joint out in the desert, odds are that your baselines are going to be very, very close. So even in areas like game selection, which is just picking new products to buy, it may be the case that some operators are vastly superior at picking than others. We simply have not seen any evidence of it whatsoever. So once slot directors understand this, we see that the failings and shortcomings lie not in the individuals, but in the state of the art and historical legacy. You know, that's really what that's about. And also with our professional services unit, we've also really started breaking up the implementation a bit functionally. So we'll spend more time with the slot team up front so that we can look at, what the decisions and the processes and the methods have been used historically. We can give them a lot of context. We can evaluate them and then make sure that, in addressing these things, defining goals and changes and things of this nature, that it doesn't, descend into some kind of political infighting or sniping internally. We really are just trying to be get them as many constructive improvements as possible. I think, Frank, there was, I think you wanted to do, did you want to discuss, there was something about, I think you wanted to go on Ricochet, something about how we stop it. Was that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you learned how to minimize?
Oh yeah. Okay. So that, yeah. And that's, that this is a very, very interesting topic. So, and honestly, were it not for the pandemic, I'd have a hell of a time answering it, right? So pre-pandemic, the Ricochet was an entirely theoretical framework. So to validate it, we would have had to have required the temporary disablement of potentially tens of thousands of machines. So the joke around here was, you know, short of a plague, that's not going to happen. Well, then what happened, right? So so the first thing we saw, of course, was the instantaneous disablement of between 30 and 50% of active devices. Everybody just started shutting games off. And critically, these were hugely biased cuts. The stars stayed active, but the dogs were disabled. So we watched the sets, and despite the reduced capacity, big reductions in footfall, and quite a few material shifts demographically, two things really jumped out in a big way. First, we saw dramatic increases in session duration and far fewer game samplings per trip. Okay, so effectively, players found those sticky games very quickly, and wouldn't you know it, they stayed put. Mm-hmm. And secondly, despite the 30 to 50% reduction in the total number of active units, we saw unit level revenue gains that were wildly disproportionate. So 2, 3, 400% lift was by no means unusual. And in fact, in many regional markets, these increases were so dramatic that the slot floors posted modest year over year revenue gains, despite a pandemic raging just outside their doors. So most were actually fairly close. They pretty much achieved a parity in a lot of cases. So the analysis is ongoing, but from everything that we've seen thus far, Ricochet is a bona fide phenomenon. And the solution, to answer your question, finally, is the consolidation via conversion, replacement, or outright removal. So we're aware of several of these initiatives, which have already kicked off, and we're involved in an advisory capacity in a couple of them.
And we've already seen that not as many machines are needed, and floors can be reconfigured in ways that are more comfortable to the player.
Oh, absolutely. And the unit count question is one I'm a little more reserved on, that because I'm not so certain that is fully justified at this point. But, you know, once I think operators really start diving into this, you know, it's going to be a hard conclusion to fight off. I think a lot of them are looking for excuses oftentimes to really reduce unit count. And I would expect that they're going to jump in heavily.
Mm-hmm. And one more follow up, you know, in the old days, there were all these assumptions, such as, you know, machines on the end of on end caps were going to earn more than machines in the middle. Have you gotten into that at all? The location of machines, the configuration of floors, and optimizing revenue from that.
Yeah, we have. In fact, it was interesting because we went about it in some way from a different angle. So when it became time to really start selecting stuff to disable, we started we put together some simulators that would go in. We you know, took into consideration the floor plan, where machines were on the banks and all this kind of stuff. And it is a linear regression model that takes into account a lot of different variables and just, you know, basically uses brute force processing power to do all those calculations. And, you know, we could get to a very detailed level in terms of advising them as to what to keep on and what to keep off. And yeah, a lot of those assumptions that we saw, you know, worked a lot with Bruce Rowe in the past, who spent a lot of time at Corporate Slots at Harrah's, John Bausche, of course, being very deeply involved in the company. So, you know, some of those old adages that we saw about floor plan and stuff, we have looked at, and yeah, a lot of them absolutely hold, yeah, no doubt about it. We test assumptions constantly, and our own more than anyone's. But yeah, those we find are actually fairly solid. There was a lot of really heavy, great work that was done at Harrah's in this realm in the 90s and 2000s, and a lot of groundbreaking stuff. And yeah, a lot of that stuff is absolutely holding, no doubt about it.
Anything else? Any other trends that you may have identified that perhaps industry professionals hadn't seen coming?
What I would say on that front is, you know, from an empirical perspective, We'd say we absolutely contend that the case for aggressive product consolidation is at this point extremely difficult to dispute. And although we don't feel that the case is as strong, let's say, for unit count reduction, again, I predict that, you know, when operators really start taking a hard look at this, there's a good chance that that's where it's going to go. With that said, the macroeconomic indicators are giving me some pause for thought. So with employment, output, and consumer confidence all pointing north, I'd say the prospect of a, you know, post-pandemic boom looks pretty good at this point. And I've been around the industry long enough to know that when the economy roars, we tend to get a little sloppy. So so it does make predicting big trends a little bit difficult, but I would see that. I would say that the probability of dramatic consolidation over the coming 12 to 24 is looking pretty good.
So I would imagine that's your priority for the coming year is helping people using data to help operators logically return to full capacity in a way that's going to be optimal to their revenues.
Yeah, we're really focusing at the present time. We're doing a lot of work in market segmentation and then understanding product resonance by market segment. So I think one of the more, you know, it was kind of an interesting story, if you don't mind me rambling on about it, but a couple of years ago, John Bausch and I, we wanted to test some assumptions that we regularly use regarding cannibalization. So specifically, when you place new performant product on the floor, there's this question, you know, to what extent is its performance derived the expense of, you know, neighboring product, right? So historically, he and I had always used a very conservative a percentage being 90%. So we said that, you know, when a new game comes on, 90% of its performance is derived from neighboring machines. But as we chugged through the data and we started modeling that, we saw this didn't hold at all. And it was a wide miss. We weren't even close. So we just kind of started looking at and thinking, you know, what the hell is going on here? This doesn't make sense to us. So ultimately, it led us to look at inventory balances and how casinos were managing their game libraries. So in looking into this, you need to consider how shelf space is managed in more mainstream retail environments. So if you look at large retailers of things like fast-moving consumer goods, what you see is this emphasis on maintaining inventory consistency across storefronts. So typically you'll see standard inventory, that is product that's wholly consistent from storefront to storefront, to the tune of around 80% of shelf space. For the balance, you have your variable inventory. And this is stuff that's really focused on, let's say, regional specialties, impulse buys, experimental stuff that's new, et cetera. And, you know, this strategy wasn't developed in a vacuum. It provides critical benefits to the retailer, including brand consistency, offering consistency. You get economies of scale in purchasing, reduced maintenance and logistical burden, all that stuff. But in the casino universe, what we found is that ratio is inverted. In fact, it's worse than inverted. And accordingly, the advantages that flow from that strategic inventory management are completely absent. So to get at this, what we did is we looked at how these casinos were managing their game libraries. So we started with our large enterprise accounts and looked at the libraries and saw an average of around 25 to 2600 active game titles per organization. Then we went in and we asked the question, okay, out of these 2600 titles, what percentage is installed on just one unit anywhere in the organization? And again, these are big inventories. And we were startled to discover that it was the number was 18%, right? So 18% were installed on just one terminal anywhere inside of that organization. We then asked, okay, so what percentage is installed on fewer than one unit per property overall on average? And we were absolutely floored to see that it was nearly 70%. So that's 88% of titles deployed in low volume configurations. And then what of the performance correlations? It was damn near linear. So when you categorize in this manner, what you see is the low volume deployments are by, 30 or 40% margin, the worst performers in the organization. So, in terms of how we arrive at some of these things, that's really where it comes from. We begin with testing our own assumptions. We get some kind of indication that they're not holding, and then down the rabbit hole we go. I'm going to start modeling it up in different ways and looking at it. It's a pretty common narrative here and a fairly typical route to insight and discovery in the company.
Okay. Finally, priorities for your company for the year: new markets, further penetration of existing markets. I just want to give you a chance to just look ahead to the coming year.
Sure. Yeah, we're absolutely continuing the march in North America. Nothing slowing down there, and it's great. Things are really starting to open up a little bit. People are taking sales calls again and whatnot. So that's fantastic. So North America will continue going good guns. We started last year in Latin America as well, and that's off to a good start. So we're starting to get some great volume down there, and we're just starting to kick off in Europe and starting to poke around a bit more in Asia too. So we're really looking at all these areas, but North America will continue to be, the dominant build out. And then functionally, we're really focused on segmentation work. And we last year began accumulating massive amounts of session data. So that's an entirely new dimension of data for us, and that is a blast. So we're really the discoveries that come in through that stuff are mind-boggling. So we continue functionally really working heavily on that stuff.
Okay, Nick Hogan, Real Metrics, thanks a lot for being with us on the podcast today.
Okay, thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed this week's podcast brought to you by IGT. Your players will experience the convenience of digital transactions throughout your resort property with IGT's resort wallet. Learn more at igt.com/cashless. To learn more about analytics and how they work in the slot industry, visit ggbmagazine.com. To get all the news of the gaming industry, particularly of the coronavirus situation and its impact on gaming, including daily updates, subscribe for free at ggbnews.com by using the code GGB180. Don't miss a single episode of the podcast. Subscribe on iTunes and Spotify today. So we'll see you next time on the GGB podcast.